Welcome to 10 Conversations for 10 Years, a series of discussions to celebrate 10 years of applying quality improvement at East London NHS Foundation Trust. Through these 10 conversations, we'll be sharing learning from the last decade, as well as looking ahead to see what the next 10 years might hold in the field of healthcare improvement. This is episode 7, in which we're going to focus on the topic of improving across a whole system. My name is Amar. I'm Chief Quality Officer at East London Foundation Trust. And I'm joined today by Professor Jason Leach, National Clinical Director in the Scottish Government, who's overseen Scotland's multi-year improvement journey, including the application of improvement far beyond the boundaries of healthcare delivery. Thank you, Jason, for joining me today, and welcome.
It's a pleasure, Amar. Thank you so much for having me. It feels like an important moment in you and your organization's history. I'm glad you're recognizing it.
Wonderful. I'm hoping over the course of the next half hour or so, Jason, we'll be able to pick your brains a little bit on how we can bring the field of healthcare improvement into partner organizations and into local communities, engaging people much more broadly than we may have done in the last 10 or 20 years, where improvement has largely been held within hospitals and healthcare settings. And it may take a bit of adaptation, a bit of learning to think about how do we make this accessible and useful in places and in partners that may not ordinarily feel that they are leading improvement in the system. I'd love to start by just hearing a little bit of your experience from Scotland about how the work of improvement has progressed over the 15 years that you've been leading the journey in Scotland. It probably began in hospitals and healthcare, but how has it evolved to go beyond that?
Well, the first thing is to say I agree with you that your diagnosis is correct, but diagnosis is the easy bit. So Michael Marmot says that about 20% of health of the nation is the result of the healthcare system, the repair system, which you and I have been born and brought up in, frankly. And the repair system in the UK is one of the best repair systems in the world, even in a challenging period that we're facing. The difficulty is the other 80% that is actually responsible for the health of the nation, whether that's air quality or criminal justice or human behavior or whatever else you want to have it in. So if you really care about the health of your own family or your broader community or the nation, then you've got to start to think about how to improve things beyond the walls of family physicians, mental health community services even. You've got to go to places where we don't naturally fit. You've got to go to the prison service. You've got to go to the education service. You've got to go to climate change. And that's what Scotland has tried to do with, frankly, limited success and some success, Amar. I mean, you're generous in your introduction. We have done point of care safety, point of care improvement, some of it learned from East London, frankly, and some of it learned from Sweden and Cincinnati and other partners around the world. We've eradicated healthcare-associated infection pretty much as well as anybody in the world. We've got a 30% reduction in surgical mortality using point-of-care checklists. So we've got all those things that you would expect me to be able to recite. And then we realized that actually the real prize was in getting children to run a mile every day or stopping people to go into prison for short sentences or fixing air pollution in our big cities. And that's where you can take the same, let's call them tools, techniques, whatever you want to call them, the models that we've used in healthcare that East London have practiced and know so well and tried to move them into these new environments.
So who have been the range of actors and partners that you've seen really embrace the application of improvement as you've been exploring taking improvement into different fields? What sorts of agencies and bodies and partners have you found connection with when you've tried to talk about improving outcomes?
So my context is different from yours, and yet I'm sure there are similarities that you could draw. So my country is pretty much all public service. I mean, the public sector, we have a very centrally managed government responsible for education, justice, health, lots of other bits of the puzzle. So it's relatively straightforward to fill a room with people who care about the subject. That's harder in a country the size of England. But in Scotland, you can put the execs who lead a thing in the room. And I remember we were about, 6 or 7 years into the patient safety work, and the guy whose title in government is Director of Children and Families. I mean, even the fact you've got a Director of Children and Families seems like an important moment. And he came to my office door, quite literally, and knocked the door and said, I hear you've got an implementation thing that might work. And I said, well, not really. I mean, we're trying. And it seems to be having some traction. And he said, well, I've been in this game for 20 years. I've got a menu of ideas. I've got recipes of evidence. And I can't get anything implemented. I don't know how to do it. And I don't have the secret sauce that takes what I know about education and kids, which was his thing, and implement it. So from that, we birthed the Early Years Collaborative, which at the time was probably the biggest collaborative with a capital C. Collaborative is a method. It's a toolkit. And it's not just about collaboration, although it includes collaboration. It's a technical way of taking evidence you know and you have and implementing it at scale in human systems. And that's what we did. And from that was born work on literacy, numeracy, health and well-being in kids running a mile every day. You might have heard of the Daily Mile. It's now done in some schools in London. And spreading those elements. So the answer to your question is it's not tricky to get the cast list to pay attention. Where we've tried to learn, don't try and persuade the whole room in a one-hour. Try and do it in stages. Take your early adopters. Invest time in capacity building in those individuals. Now, all I did really was change the cast list from surgeons, midwives, healthcare executives to prison officers, head teachers, mums and dads. So the table changed, but the method and the models we used and the persuasion and the putting the customer in the center, that all stayed the same. But round the table was very different because you had now had a social worker, an obstetrician, and an English teacher. And the English teacher hadn't been in the room previously. And we had police officers learning the model for improvement and how to do statistics. So I have never found that if you make the thing engaging, engagement is a problem. Implementation is a problem, and don't misunderstand me. It's hard work. But I don't think the engagement bit is the bit that we've struggled with.
Some of our early experiences of trying to work with partners around tackling a health outcome weren't that successful here. We tried in one borough in Tower Hamlets. We experimented with trying to work with a range of partners around outcomes for three different populations in the community. And frankly, we made very little headway. And it was partly because I think there was this sense that it was being led by the health system. And actually, we played a very minor role in the outcomes that we were actually trying to shift. And I wondered how what experience you might have of putting healthcare in the support role rather than the lead role for this. Give some tips and advice to people who want to work on these outcomes, but don't want to make sure that we are not trying to lead people towards them when we probably don't have the right to lead. But we do have some experience of improving systems that might be useful.
Yeah, and I think that's the classic walk in other people's shoes, isn't it? Einstein said he would, if he had his time again, he would spend 90% of his time in understanding the system and 10% on the solutions. And we have a model in Scotland, an improvement model in Scotland that makes it look as though understanding the system is the same size of work as improving this. It isn't. Understanding the system is where you should invest your time and your clever people. So the first lesson is to go to the work, to be humble and go to where the work is. And that work might be a homeless shelter. It might be actually damp housing. I've been in more prisons in Scotland than I ever thought I would be in because I'm trying to understand what it is to be a leader or an inmate in those environments. If I want to fix Scotland's outrageous drug problem, you've got to try and understand what that is, humbly and inquiring. And then you convene or you get a community leader or community leaders to convene. And what you bring to that is I hope, a humility, a history of, look, we had these problems. Look, this is how we managed it. This is, well, we don't understand your context. Please help us understand it. The thing that unites, in my experience, is, and this is shorthand, and some people won't like the word, is customer. So the thing that unites is always the user. Now, that user could be a family. It could be a patient in intensive care. It could be a homeless shelter. Whatever the customer for the thing you're trying to fix is. And if you bring the customer to that convening environment, a lot of that hierarchical nonsense, that all disappears. So you have to come in with an inquiring mind. And I've seen East London do that. I've seen you do that personally into that environment. You need to spend time with what we would call third sector organizations who are in this space. I remember calling a meeting about pressure ulcers in Scotland. And we thought we were the only people fixing pressure ulcers. And we called this meeting, we got about 200 people who thought pressure ulcers were their job. And if I didn't respect the work they had done in the past and try and help them with the work that we're going to do in the future, why on earth would they take me seriously? So we have to engage with people who are in the space, homelessness, criminal justice, health and education, whatever it might be, and then try and help them with the toolkit that might just move them and accelerate them to the next stage. Credit is infinitely divisible, as Don Berwick of IHI often says, and it's a lesson I've had to relearn again and again.
That's a powerful line, Jason. I totally agree with you about putting the user, the customer, right at the center, the purpose really driving the work. Having tried and experimented in Tower Hamlets and failed many years ago, we tried again a few years later and actually saw a very different result. And I think it was partly because when we worked on childhood asthma, we really put the children and the parents in the driving seat for this, really understanding what was the issue that they were facing, framing it in their words. The children talked about monster days, the days when their asthma was so bad that it was like a monster they were fighting with, and the days of school that they were missing, and the days of work that the parents had to take off. And that really allowed a team of actors in the system to come together and see how we could do things differently. And actually that project managed to reduce attendance at A&E and reduce costs for the system as well as improve outcomes. And that was a really beautiful piece of work. How do you work with leaders in partner organizations to shift their mindset about decision-making and where the solution should come from? In the same way that for healthcare improvement, we have to work with our leaders to help them see that better solutions are likely to come from the people who use our services and the people who are in closest contact with them. That may not be a mindset that's held in all services.
Yeah, I think this is tricky. So let's do the good news first. So I've never met a public sector leader or a charity leader or somebody engaged in this broad work we're talking about who doesn't want to make it better for their users. And I've never met a leader who doesn't care about their workforce and trying to make it better for the workforce. But we have designed a system of siloed executive leadership, siloed funding, siloed. So therefore, that creates protective mechanisms of work. We all do it because we're trying to make our bit of the puzzle survive and make it good and decent for our staff who we look after and our jobs and our executive leaders. So we're all guilty of that. Slightly easier in Scotland because we at least own it all. That's a horrible expression, but we at least manage all of it from the centre. But we have the same challenges of local government versus central government, of social care versus healthcare. We have all of that thing going on. I think, again, if you focus on customer, you get over some of that. There are then high-level conversations that have to happen. And here is where we sometimes get confused, I think, Emma. The people doing the work need to leave that parallel process to the leaders. So they should expose that challenge and they should say, look, the funding streams here are not working for us. That needs worked out and the leaders should be responsible for that. But we shouldn't confuse that with the work of the workforce who are making it better on the ground for patients and families. And you can do the two things at the same time. You don't have to wait for the leaders. East London's a good example of this. You lit a touch paper, a as far as I can tell from the outside, and let improvement happen. And at the same time, you worked on the leadership. You didn't work on the leadership and then think 4 years later, right, let's do some projects. You let those things happen simultaneously. You need linkers like you, people who can bridge those gaps and tell the stories to the leaders. And I have found when you convene, in my world, politicians, cabinet members, leaders of local government, leaders of healthcare systems, and say, look, we want to fix literacy in seven-year-olds, or we want to help with the disability community in your town. They engage. They come. They then have conversations about who should fund, who should all of that. And of course they do, because it's a limited resource world. And I have found engaging them maturely actually gets you to where you need to go. We also, the only other thing is, we also have formal training. I mean, you don't naturally know how to be an improver. Improvement is not genetic. It can be learned. I mean, some personalities move towards it quicker than others. But yesterday I was speaking at the launch of our 19th cohort of what we call quality fellows in Scotland, 36 people, some from other parts of the world, in order to pay for the Scottish people to be able to do it for free. And we're teaching them the tools. I mean, there's leaders in that room, there's associate medical directors, there's senior nurses, there's people from local government learning the toolkit, but we're teaching them the statistical process control, we're teaching them how to have difficult conversations. There's a toolkit that you can learn that helps you make those changes.
So let's dive into that for a minute, Jason, because I wonder whether there, for improvers out there, what should we be doing to make the method and tools of improvement accessible to people who are coming from very different contexts and backgrounds? You know, we sometimes there's a really powerful opportunity for improvement to be a common language, but equally, it can be a barrier for people too, that they feel like there's this scientific method, this set of jargon, this preponderance on data and charting, which sometimes is a bit alien for people in the way that they go about their work and making things better. So what should we as improvers be thinking about? I mean, how do we frame improvement? How do we position it? How do we bring people to it in a non-threatening way that allows them to learn and apply it in their own setting with their own experiences and background?
I think the fact you're even asking the question is mature, because I think it's a crucial question. You and I are geeks. You and I have been in many rooms all over the world, and we love a pyramid model and a lot of circles and Venn diagrams. But we're special. I mean, there's not a lot of people like those rooms. And I think that room's important, because I think we need to move the models on. These models are for geeks, and if you walk into a room of high school teachers or prison officers or police officers, the first slide has to be narrative about story. It has to be about mums and dads and kids and carers and prisoners and people who people care about. That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to drive the change. Of course, then you can move to the models about how we might do iterative change and how you might do a cycle of change and then learn from it and come back and fail and learn again. And you might have to count something. Most people will engage with the data in their environment. But if you start with an Excel spreadsheet, you'll find about 2% of the crowd will love you. If you start with story and narrative about change and engaging with workforce, then you're much more likely to get there. And then you can start to add in the tools. And we've got really skilled teachers now. So yesterday in that early day of that fellowship program, I mean, they didn't get big models, they didn't get fancy diagrams, they got story from previous fellows who had been through this process, had done projects, had made change and engaged a team. Now today, day two, they'll get a little bit of an introduction to some statistics and how they might count in their individual project. Then they'll get personality stuff later on today. So you can see you can introduce those elements gradually. But if you start with a fancy PDSA cycle on a flip chart, you're going to just switch everybody right off.
I totally agree with that. I mean, about half of our improvement work at East London now is with a partner organization. And then it's genuinely just evolved naturally as teams have recognized that to tackle the things they really care about and their service users really care about, they have to go and seek partners to influence the factors that they need to be able to influence. So actually, half of our work is already with partner agencies. And last week, we had 250 people in a room learning about improvement in our 13th Improvement Leaders Program. And one in five of them were from outside our organization. Firefighters, local authority, community partners, charities. We even had a local reverend join us last year, leading a QI project now in their faith community.
So you underestimate probably what even the convening power of that does. But the actual work happens in the coffee queue and in the drinks afterwards and in the morning arrivals and all of that. I remember way back when we were trying to fix intensive care and we tried to persuade a whole room of people and it didn't go well. Five critical care leaders, four doctors and one nurse approached me in the coffee queue and said, we would like to try this. There's 600 people here, but we would like to try it. And those five became the first five to do the thing. So all improvement is relational, and you've created an environment where those relationships can build. And if Tower Hamlets is not going to be transformed by a flowchart and an Excel spreadsheet. It's going to be transformed because that pastor meets an obstetrician who meets a social worker, and they gather. Now, you also need to give them tools. It doesn't happen spontaneously. You've got to feed it and then hold it accountable and have some assurance around it and make sure the leaders know that pastor and the obstetrician are now working together. All of that still has to happen. But the core of that is the relationship. And that's what collaboratives, convening that you've done, leads to, I think.
England has set itself on a course of embedding improvement across the entire nation, working with systems and providers and regions, and NHS England committing as well to go on its own continuous improvement journey over multiple years. And that's a really strong signal of intent, I think, that there is value in bringing this systematic method to help solve problems, and that problems are better solved closer to the point of care. And that there is value in the method and tools that we can bring. What would you suggest, you know, having done a similar work across a nation, might be the areas that England should be thinking about, focusing on, if we're really going to encourage integrated care systems, regions to take an improvement approach across a much broader field of partners than just the healthcare providers?
First of all, I think it's terrific. I think it's the most coherent version of an English approach I've seen in the last 10 to 15 years. I think it's really important. People are saying the right things, but more than that now, it would appear there is infrastructure, resource, actual mission around this from top downwards. I think that's really, really important. This is a little bit controversial, probably. So there's some people who think embedding improvement, and we should make it the daily business, and there shouldn't be a department of quality. It should be everybody's job. And yes, I understand all that theory. I read it. I get it. I actually like a mug with a logo on it and a lanyard and a mouse mat and a t-shirt, because I think inside our really complex human systems, having mission and purpose is really important. The thing that irritates me most about the multiple meetings I'm in every day is when somebody says, we want to fix delayed discharges. Great, let's fix that. And then somebody over here says, what about climate change? Well, okay, yes, of course, we want to fix climate change. But this fellow over here wants to fix delayed discharges. Now you've complexified the problem by making the problem bigger. And well, what about war? Yeah, I want to fix war too. But can we go back to the guy who wants to fix the pressure ulcers? Because we've got some tools that might be able to do that. So I think one of the challenges in England is mission and purpose. And I think bigger countries find that harder. I see it in France. I've seen it in parts of big states in America and Canada. And in Scotland, we had the advantage, 5.5 million people, 21 chief executive. I mean, I can get them all in a room. And we chose safety as the mission. Now, there was a debate at the beginning about, is that really where we want to start? Should we start with efficiency? Should we start with effective care? Should we do person-centered? And there was arguments for each of them. Very good arguments, compelling arguments. The fundamental problem is you can't do everything on the same day. You have to start. So I think NHS Impact has to choose what to do. And that has to be, of course, capacity building, has to choose method, has to do all of those things, but it has to choose mission and purpose. And in Scotland, mission and purpose initially was safety, moving on to kids, as we've just described. Now we're in climate change. So the fella in the room who says, remember climate change, we're now working on climate change. But you can't do everything on a Tuesday. You've got to have something. And I think humans engage around something that gets everybody excited. And you'll annoy some people because you won't pick their project. I don't know whether that applies in a 70 million country. Maybe you need 7 of them. Maybe you need 10 of them. Maybe you need regions. I don't know. You understand your system better than me. But in my world, having a big mission that you put on a mug was hugely helpful for us.
So Jason, as we get to the end of the conversation, I'm taking away your really sound advice about the power of convening people together and then making sure we're grounded in clear purpose, a purpose that really resonates and is wrapped around the user, the end user, the customer, the population, and what they need and want. And then making sure we equip people with the tools, the method in a non-threatening way, in a way that's accessible and simple to use, but really focusing on relationships, convening, and purpose. That's the sort of key things I'm taking away from this. I wonder whether you might finish off, Jason, by giving some simple tips that anyone could try out in their improvement practice anywhere in the world. If they wanted to start moving from working on flow and safety and service user experience, and they wanted to start moving outside of the walls of healthcare, and they may not have the influence that you and I could have in big organizations to be able to engage with partners at a senior level. But, you know, if you're working in a team or with a team, what could you do to just start getting outside of the walls and influencing things beyond just care delivery?
I think you've answered it well. I've kind of invented a bit of a model, the Leech model. It's the three things you need. It's the three things you need for change. And it's tools, pals, and courage. Tools, pals, and courage. And I think that is the answer to your question. The tools are part of the puzzle. Of course, you need to learn what to do. You need to learn your personality types. You need to learn how to have conversations. You need to learn statistics. So there's a tools bit, a bit like learning to be an orthopedic surgeon or learning to be a family doctor or learning to be a senior nurse. You need pals. Improvement can be lonely because it's relentless. This is not done in boardrooms. This is done in the work where it's sometimes messy, you sometimes fail, and you sometimes have to get up again and go again. So you need friends. Now, that's created sometimes by the convening, as you've just described. And then the third thing in my model, for what it's worth, is courage, because you have to step up. That nobody else is going to lead this for you. So you can waste an awful lot of energy complaining about other people. But if you look up and complain, you're just wasting your energy. Stephen Covey, who wrote Seven Habits, he talks about your circle of influence and your circle of concern. Your circle of concern is, of course, global war, climate change, of course. But if you want to spend all your time out there, then good luck to you, because you'll probably not change very much. Your circle of influence is the bit you have been given responsibility for. And that might be a single relationship with a patient tomorrow. It might be a relationship with a social worker who you've never met, who you reach out to and say, look, I'm really struggling with delays inside my bit of the puzzle. Is there any way I can understand your job better so that I can help with what you're trying to do? Don't go and blame the social care system. That's not going to help anybody. But go and learn the social care system so they'll come to you and they'll understand what it is to be a GP or a practice nurse or a dentist or an optometrist inside your bit of the puzzle. So that courage to step out of your natural environment in your circle of influence. And then something magic happens. People who do that end up with a bigger circle of influence because change is not expected. People don't expect it to get better. And when it gets better, that attracts other people. And you end up with half a dozen people coming to your thing. And you end up with a dozen people at your thing. And now you've started to have an influence beyond where you began. And it works better and better, I think.
Tools, pounds, courage, the leech model. You heard it here first, folks. A lot of wisdom in that, Jason. Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to speak to you and to draw out some of the learning from so many years of experience of improvement across a wide system in Scotland. So thank you so much for joining me today, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. And congratulations on 10 years on this journey to your organisation.
Thanks, Jason. And I hope you'll join me for the next episode 8, coming soon. Thanks, everyone.